we're going to find someone who will do a bit of living history. And we have searched for someone who would do it about an individual, about a family, about an industry, but something that would share with us a bit of history that you would never read in any book, magazine, or printed written material. And we know that those who we call, as you read our 1984 town history, which I'm sure everybody has, that we call our summer folks, our summer residents. They are very much a part of the fabric of our community, and they've given us the quality that we feel we hold tightly to. And so we began thinking around, and I said, I know someone that I think we'd all be interested if she'd just tell us a little bit about her Glessner family and growing up in the Bronx. You know, we've had to share a sort of ownership in those two directions with Bethlehem. And it is true that geographically, they belong there. So I'm glad that Ann Carter's telephone number is a little and we feel that there are many ties here. So many of our families were employed on the Rocks Estate. Some will call me wanting to come tonight, were because of memories that they had there. We know that they were responsible for the starting of our hospital association, for many bits of progress in the town. And the nice part is, generations along the line, they're still stayed in this part of the country, year-round, we hope, but at least for a good part of the year. And it is my privilege tonight to introduce to you Ann Carter, who says she's really afraid of us. But, you know, we all know.
Until they built 1800 Prairie Avenue.
in 1886. I have a picture of that on the back. This house was designed by the remarkable and imaginative architect Henry Cobson Richardson. Thanks to the genius and ability of Francis Wessner, added to Richardson's, they made this a most distinguished, happy, and comfortable home, where they lived to the end of their days, despite the fact that business came in to crowd out their neighbors from what was one of the nicest residential districts of the city, and they were nearly the only family left. In his introduction to his scrapbook, John Jacob writes, "It has not been the fortune of my ancestors to perform any notable action or acquire widely extended fame, but they were a sterling, honest, upright set of people who acted their part to the best of their knowledge and opportunity, who never sullied the family name by dishonorable dealings, and from whom we never need feel ashamed to have descended." And then he adds a small bit of verse. "Honor and fame from no condition rise. Act well your part, there all the honor lies." His son, my grandfather, John George Macbeth Wessner, was born in 1871, and he died a month before I was born, in 29. He married Alice Mary Hamlin, my grandmother, in 1897. They had four children, Elizabeth, my mother, Francis, John, and Emily. As I told you, John Jacob and Francis had a second child, John Francis, who died in infancy. Their third child was Francis, my great-aunt. She eventually married Lewis Lee, and they had three children. Martha Lee Batchelder, the youngest, is a frequent resident at the Rocks Cottage, where her mother lived, and which she may occupy as long as she likes. All this property is now owned by the Society for the Protection of the Hampshire Forest, as you know. For my part in telling these stories, the Wessners, particularly my grandmother, will be the centerpiece. All of our childhood summers revolved around this elegant lady, and a good many of our winters. So let's go back a bit for a moment. I'll probably go back and forth as I think of more things. I probably confuse you, but never mind. I'll do my best. But in 1875, or thereabouts, my grandfather George became afflicted with severe hay fever. In order to give him relief from this, the family spent several summers at the Twin Mountain House in New Hampshire. And John Jacob bought the first farm to make the Rocks Estate in 1883. And the next year, he built the Big House as his summer home. We all call it the Big House. After graduating from Harvard, George joined his father in the family business, Warder, Mitchell & Company, makers of reapers and mowers, later to become Warder, Bushnell & Wessner, which was eventually sold to International Harvester, of which John Jacob Wessner became vice president. George and Francis and their respective families lived near Senior Wessner's on Prairie Avenue on Southside, Chicago. But after the International Harvester Company was formed, George and Alice made their permanent home in a stone and wood cottage that J.J.G. had built on the Rocks Estate. And George revived and built up the Bethlehem Electric Company. Then he built for himself and his family a two-story frame house on the estate at the top of the hill. We all call that, or it was called the ledge. It did have vast ledges of stone, granite out back. Marion Miles Finn, who worked at the Rocks, mostly for my grandparents at the ledge, remembers Mr. Wessner was always off in Bethlehem at the electric company. He'd go off every morning with his Scotty whiskey, with his lunch pail. Marion loved him, I think because he was an unpretentious man. She was not so sure about how his wife Alice felt about all this. She was perhaps a bit of a snob. Anyhow, Marion was a part of my life from the start, and she still is, but she's going strong at 90, well, she's almost 91. She helped me a lot with this. She came to work at the ledge at age 14 as a scullery maid, and when you consider that practically all the food eaten came from the place, she had a terrible lot of vegetables to scrub every day as a start. She says it was a regular city in itself up there. There were at least 90 people employed. You could have a different bowl every night. Furthermore, if you didn't have any offers of an evening, Mrs. Jobin, the cook, would persuade her to walk, and this is true, to Littleton, to the movies, and walk back, along the road. Coincidentally, both sets of westerners, father and son, have seven grandchildren, and it is the second seven that I'm primarily concerned with this evening. However, to go back to Chicago for a last minute for a hard-to-believe story that will tie in later, as you will see, with my cousin Simon Stackpole's memories. John Jacob Lesner wrote that every Sunday morning, quoted him, all seven of my grandchildren came together to our house to spend the morning with toys we provided. And there never was a dispute, seven kids, or a word of conflict among them. And never has there been since. I have it booked. Each child picked out the toy he or she wanted, and no two wanted the same toy. My mother, Elizabeth Lesner, married Robert Edge, an Englishman, in 1928. She was the firstborn of George and Alice, and she had two children, myself and then my sister Alice. Frances Lesner came next, and she married Rene Matte, a Swiss, in 1927. They had one son, George Rene, and then a daughter, Simone May. Oh, Simone, she's helped me a lot with this. John Jacob Lesner II was next. He married Martha Sluder of St. Louis in 1930. They had three children, John Jacob Lesner III, Ellen Cochran, and Virginia Sluder, in that order. Seven cousins. Emily Lesner was the fourth and last born of my grandparents' children. She married a man named Lewis Warren later in life, but they had no children. As I said, I'm repeating myself here. My grandfather's sister, Frances, married Lewis Lee in 1898. They had three children, thus making the first set of seven cousins. John Lester Lee, Frances Lee Mark, and Martha Lee Batchelor. My great-aunt Frances Lee eventually came to live in the cottage at the bottom of the hill that had been her brother's first home at the Rocks. And Martha Batchelor, whose home was in Milton, Massachusetts, as I said earlier, a frequent resident here. So it's with some fear and trepidation that I shall recount some of the life we led as children, spending almost every summer at the Rocks. For I wonder just how interesting to you might be all these childhood reminiscences. But Van Heel said to go for it, and I have elicited help with as many cousins as I could corral. Matter of fact, I did pretty well. I got one letter yesterday, which I could not incorporate, so if I say six out of seven responded very well. But the other cousin, the littlest, the youngest, is in Belize, and she couldn't be communicated, so we knew where she is exactly. We use the house names, the Big House and the Ledge. The Rocks was too all-encompassing, and besides, great Aunt Frances Lee was in the cottage at the entrance with the Rocks sign, and we thought of that name as hers. We were all thoroughly frightened of her. She seemed a formidable lady, and she and my grandmother didn't get on that well. When we came for the summer, we usually stayed in the Big House, where there was masses of room for three families, their nursemaids, animals, and household help. There always seemed to be plenty of the latter. My grandmother resided at the Ledge, where she could observe the goings-on at a safe distance and participate as she chose. We all adored her. Among the many treats she dispensed from time to time were the special invitations to dinner and the night, two of us at a time, with our favorite foods for dinner and a delicious breakfast the next morning. There were lots of talk and laughter, as well as gentle quizzing at the table. My cousin George and I would usually go together, and we were practically the same age, and Yami, and that's the name I refer to her as probably, so go along and go with that, liked the age to match fairly well. Perhaps then she wouldn't have to adjust the conversational level to all. After breakfast, which always began with Mrs. Susie Quimby's, she was the cook that I best remember, creamy oatmeal, she cooked it on the big black wood-burning stove very slowly all night, so it was the consistency of thick cream. Then we added brown sugar and real thick cream on top. It was heavenly. George never gained a pound, but I did for it. Anyway, after breakfast, George and I would run back down the hill to crow it over the others until their turns came. The Swiss cousins, Simon and George, didn't come every summer, just every other usually. And when we were really young and they spoke only French, we had trouble communicating at the beginning. So it was decided to employ a French governess, two, one, teach my sister and niece French, and two, make George and Simon more at home in their own language. George learned English rapidly, but he had to, as we were learning French from a translation of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, and we weren't moving ahead very fast. As a matter of fact, we were hopelessly bored, as was our mademoiselle, and wanted nothing more than to get out and play. She was relatively strict, but she couldn't run. And what a marvelous estate for this to play. The true meaning of that word becomes clear when you think of the acres of land available to us. No French governess could possibly keep a watchful eye on our doings. There were paths everywhere, with no end of secret hiding places. As a matter of fact, hide-and-go-seek was our favorite game. One could hide forever and only come in when hunger called or evening fell. There were wonderful summer houses on some of these paths with special names. The Bee House, the Bluebird Summer House, the Big Rock Summer House. Actually, the Bee House was where my great-grandmother raised bees at one time. So the house always smelled especially warm and sweet. An indescribable smell coming from years of honeymaking. And the wood was saturated with this scent. I think it still is, as a matter of fact, because the society has maintained it extremely well. It's a lovely place to go to. The best house of all was the one built by my great-grandfather's daughter, Frances Lee. It stood, actually it was a real log cabin, off the driveway to the big house, just down the hill from the ledge. So between the two houses, everything in it was child-sized, and we were allowed to play in it very occasionally, and very carefully. It had upholstered pieces of furniture, curtains, a pretty rug on the floor, and a little kitchen, the greatest place to play house. I used to get the cook to give me a bit of butter and flour, mix this up, and fry it on the tiny stove, and serve it to George, or whoever else wanted to. In fact, you know, they're very delicious combinations. Mrs. Lee moved it down to behind the cottage, which is where it is now, where she used it for her office. And I believe, recently, Martha Batchelder has given some of the furnishings to the Weston House in Chicago. The house is there. We always had ponies to ride. There were two, in residence, so to speak, during my childhood. Marshmallow, a big, lazy brown and white calico, and Ginger, a feisty, small, very fat little one, anxious always to go home to eat. She turned around and go home with the slightest chance we didn't have the strength to hold back on the road. And there was a beautiful black and white Indian pony named Wing that we had for several summers. George Mante and I used to argue over who would ride him. He was a bit mean and would do his best to get us off his back by brushing by trees and rocks, and he often succeeded with me. And then we had several English saddles and one Western saddle, and we all wanted to use this one, the Western one, naturally, so we could hold on to the pommel, not fall off. I remember the times the big, heavy-set blacksmith would come to look after the horses and ponies. He would take care of their hooves and shoe them. Prince and Major got done first, as they were the huge work horses, the most important on the place, until the advent of the Jeep. My cousin George reminded me, in 1944 or 45. The hiss and sputter of cooling water, the wonderful creak of his leather apron, his mouth full of nails to be hammered in, and the horses were so patient. My grandmother rode often, always side saddle. We have a picture of her there. And my Aunt Emily was a beautiful horsewoman also. She had a handsome horse named Mr. Butcher. And I think he was named after the famous butler in Dorothy Sayers' Lord Peter Wimsey's detective story. And nobody could touch Mr. Butcher except her. And we didn't want to anyway, as he really was mean. He had his own box. A box stall in the barn, and the others just had plain open back stalls. And Butcher would hang his head out of his door whenever we were doing things like cleaning tack or currying the ponies, and hope for a chance to knit if we got too close. Aunt Emily never stood for his nonsense, but he knew we were scared. We had a lovely big swimming pool down the hill from the big house near the bee house. In those days, there were no liners or chemicals now that people use now to keep the pools continually clean from vacuums and things. So the pool had to be drained and scrubbed from time to time. Eventually, as the number of employees lessened on the place, it was decided we children would do the cleaning. If we wanted to use the pool, we had to do this. Besides, the adults thought it would be character building.
wheel the brooms and scrubbers, but George remembers, and I do too, the worst part was filling it. Slowly, icy, garnet mountain water, and hoping the sun would warm it as it filled. It had been dirty but warm before, and we dreaded getting used to the cold again. It really truly numbed the feet, awfully. I remember my short dates here. I remember my great-grandfather, John Jacob, from a visit in 1934. I would have been five, I guess. And my mother and I stayed with him at the big house in the early spring. He would have been 91 then, but he was an upright old man with a sparkle in his eyes even then. I can recollect lots of kindly teasing. He ate a large breakfast, felt it was the most important meal of the day, never had lunch, and a modest supper. He ate an orange breakfast by skewering it with a fork and taking a legally sharp knife and pare it around, all the way around, and around and around, without breaking off anywhere. He'd hand the skin to me to throw over my shoulder and told me the letter he formed on the floor would be the first letter of my true love's name. I didn't have a true love at the age of five. As I got older, I practiced this trick often. He liked an afternoon drive, so to my mother's embarrassment, she and I went along. We traveled at the snail's pace in his chauffeur limousine. It was usually on a Sunday. Over to Bethlehem, back, holding up the top, the town bed, holding up a mile of cars behind us, who were also out for their Sunday afternoon trip. He would not allow the chauffeur to exceed 20 miles an hour, if that. I think perhaps it was Jack Burnell who was the most embarrassed. He was the chauffeur. He often came up in the winters, Christmas, and early spring vacations. My cousin Ellen Gressner Wadsworth wrote about these times in a note she sent me, and I quote from her pages. We skied down the reservoir hill and climbed back up on wooden skis, dressed much too warmly in heavy wool clothing. I remember when some visiting friend from far away Sugar Hill, came to tea with Gabby and remarked that there was a mountain in Franconi with an aerial tramway. Yo. Ellen remembers finally being proclaimed ready to go up in the tram and ski all the way down again. There was fresh powder, a lot of it, she says, and the mountains sparkled. It was a coming of age, a special moment. We had a wonderful double runner sled that her father, Uncle John, made, on which most of us could sit. It was very long, and we'd take these hair-raising rides from the top of Reservoir Hill to the barns at the bottom. George would nearly always be the pilot. And some poor cousin handled the brake. A stick in the back, you pulled on it and scraped out the snow, but it would come off every time it was dragged. And there it would be. Poor my man. George Matte embellishes this story in his contribution to this talk. Piles of cousins on top of each other, gathering speed on the downhill run, in order to get through the covered archway at the barn. There was no snow there. On the dirt, and out onto the snow. Again, down to Mrs. Durante's gas station. That's what now is McGetty's, John Stevenson's gas station, but it was always Mrs. Durante's in my childhood, where there was a wonderful candy counter. We kept her in business with our things, and we visited her often in the summers, too, on horseback and on bikes. The trick was to plan it so that one of the grown-ups would be coming back from town, and we could hitch the sled to the lumber and have it towed back up the hill. George remembered Mike Finn making ice cream in the cellar of the village on Sundays for the inevitable big Sunday lunches. Mike would let us help, turn the paddles, and scrape them afterward. We did a lot more scraping than turning. Let me assure you, these Sunday lunches usually consisted of roast chicken, mashed potatoes, peas, or corn, depending on which one was in season that month. The peas, my grandmother and Mr. Marin, down the road, had a yearly contest. Whoever had the first peas by the 4th of July could boast about it all of us in summer. The corn was Tom Thumb, straight from the garden and into the pot and then onto the table. And we would have contests as to see how many ears we could eat until finally the grown-ups would sort of say, well, that's enough for now. Every cousin, remember our frequent, and I put this in quotes, frequent. If you could call them, A grandmother would decide on a certain day. Okay. After seeing about the weather in the morning, the cook would be instructed to prepare fried chicken, deviled eggs, ham sandwiches. These were really elegant. This, you know, the, crust cut off. Never a crust. Iced tea, as only Roman Obando, the butler, could make. He had a secret recipe, and the crushed mint and orange juice were involved. But I've tried to make it, and it never tasted quite right. And cookies and other goodies. Everything went into big baskets, which Roman and Jack Burnell carried. There's a picture of them doing that in my collection there. Whatever place Gammy chose. Rugs were spread, silver and napkins set out, and we feasted royally. Of course, no ants came near. Oh, never. Often these picnics were celebrated on a birthday or somebody who came to visit my grandmother. And they were really occasions. Never forgotten. Ellen lets her memory sort of flow freely, so I'll just pull it here and add my bits and go on. She said, I remember the smells of the ledge. I, too, remember the furniture polish with beeswax and something possibly lemon oil still linger in my house from those days, from certain pieces that came over to the West Farm. And one snake is all the place to go back. There were flowers everywhere. As my cousin Dr. Bachelor remarked, the adults didn't arrange, they fixed flowers. Every morning, every single morning after the gardeners brought the baskets to the houses, we were fascinated with the children. Sweet peas were the main thing I remember. It smelled especially marvelous, and those colors. And Ellen goes on, the bedrooms, each with its own name. My favorite was the spinster's room. The big bed squeaked loudly if you moved an inch. I still have it. The big oriental carpets everywhere, especially on the staircase where we children would creep down as far as we dared to eavesdrop on the many carpets and see the lovely folks. Ellen remembers the attic, trunks full of wonderful clothes to pick from and dress up, long flowing laces and silks, and hats and furs, high-heeled satin shoes, all of the manner of finery. Now, my cousin Simon, who's here, prepares some notes with her memories. They're very refreshing. I recall a few healthy good fights I had with my cousin Alice. That's my sister. She loved it. One was in a sand pile that was well stocked with toys. Tractors, dump trucks, bulldozers, and the like. We would throw these things at each other with a vengeance. She said, why? I can't recall. Now, you remember the earlier story I told you about this evening of John Jacob West's angelic grandchildren? Well, that's not going to happen with this seven. Seymour continues another fight. Set up a fight was on the porch at the big house playing jacks. We were either terrible losers or terrible winners. But Simon and George, this is just interesting to put this in, remember the time after our grandmother died, when the families tried to maintain the place without much help. This meant helping with the haying, dump runs in the Ford truck they called Little Toot, getting stuck occasionally down the pig pen and having to go for help with miserable embarrassment, weeding the garden, most unhappily, the potato garden, and helping with the maple sugar. As Simon has put it, we had to do some serious work for change. These few years were difficult and very different from the salad days before the Second World War. My sister Alice says it all in one nice paragraph, and with a few repetitions, if you'll allow, I'll just read it as a closing. It's really a summation of everything in this story. In everyone's memories, there hopefully is a time and place where love was unconditional and your world was full of fun and without much to do but play. These are my memories of the ledge and of my grandmother. She had a beautiful, soft, kind face. I always felt she loved me no matter how naughty I had been. She made me feel unselfconscious, as if my spindly legs, pigeon toes, and big nose weren't there, and I could do anything I wanted, and it was all right with her. Even better, she presided over a house where that feeling prevailed. Where the grandchildren were there. Roman, Marie, Mrs. Quimby, Mike, Jack Purnell, Danny Meehan. Everyone loved it when we came. Took wonderful care of us and made us feel that whatever we wanted, they would take great pleasure in helping us. Mrs. Quimby made delicious creamy oatmeal. Roman and Marie made Coca-Cola from syrup because you couldn't get the bottles during the war. Iced tea in lovely colored stemmed glasses. Corn on the cob, as much as you could eat. Gammy was always there at the head of the table in her black dress and lovely soft gray hair, held up in a bun with big hairpins. rode horses, helped with hay, jumped in the hay, in the hay piles in the barn, swam and played in the pool, built towns and roads in the dirt piles in the shed next to the big house, dressed up in long white cotton petticoats which came out of trunks of old clothes in the attic of the beds, dried on Aunt Emily's rhinestone high heel shoes, and pulled the curtains on her four-poster bed. My memories of it are all plenty, and Gary was always there, and anything he did was all right with him. To quote from a book Harry and I have read recently, all things...